From KCUR News, this is Casey Currents reporting news and culture in Kansas City's diverse communities and beyond. I'm Susan Wilson.
And I'm Sylvia Maria Gross. On today's show, local basketball fans look west to Wichita.
Of course, all of the t-shirt companies, retail outlets are going crazy. Our bookstore is going crazy. Wichita's on fire.
Hear about the battle over the legacy of basketball inventor James Naismith.
Plus, we look at a controversial Kansas-born religious faith.
I think the really interesting thing is how people create stories and narratives to try to explain their past.
And meet the voice of the Royals.
Here comes Relish on the inside. Ketchup looks like it's out of it. Neck and neck. Wiener to wiener, here they come.
Listen up for Casey Currents just after this hour's news.
I'm Sylvia Maria Gross.
And I'm Susan Wilson. Casey Currents is KCUR's weekly magazine show. We use voices, stories, and sound to take you to neighborhoods around the region.
The Wichita State Shockers lost 68-72 to Louisville in the Final Four of the NCAA tournament Saturday night. The team had become a de facto home team for Kansas Cityans after Mizzou, KU, and K-State were all out of the picture. Despite the loss, Wichita State's early upsets in the tournament resulted in a big bump in interest in the Kansas school. Last week, Bill Anderson spoke to the director of admissions, Bobby Gandu, about it.
You know, we're the little guy, and we understand that, and we're proud of that, too. And so it's really something to see our students get so excited about making their trip to the Final Four, or at least just watching it here and making plans and those kinds of things. Our students, you know, have a new reason, really, to connect with the university. It's really something that it's hard to describe, to be honest.
Yeah. And how does this play into interest in the university and possible future enrollment at Wichita State?
Well, certainly, we've seen a lot more traffic, both in what we call admissions inquiries. Mm-hmm. In the last month or so, we've actually seen growth in more than 50% of admissions traffic to our website in particular. So that's great. But we also see it in other levels, too. We know that Wichita State, where is Wichita State University being Googled, is up almost 1,000%. From the same time last year. Similarly, other folks are probably still learning how to spell Wichita. For example, we know that Wichita State University Googled as witches in Wichita, as though it was witch, you know, like a witch on a broom.
Right.
Well, that has been misspelled Googled more than 600% since the same time frame last year.
So you're tracking those kind of statistics,
yeah,
too.
Yeah.
Has it given or will do you foresee this giving the school endowment fund a bit of a boost?
That would certainly be my guess. That's a little bit outside my area of expertise,
yeah.
But I know our CEO and president of our Wichita State University Foundation has certainly publicly commented that she's expecting, you know, more interest from our alumni and really from others here in the Wichita and national community that like the exposure and like the direction that Wichita State's going. And so hopefully they'll open up their pocketbooks.
Yeah, well, you know, I have to say, as a guy who lives in Lawrence, Kansas, we thought there would be a team in Kansas in the Final Four. We just didn't think it'd be Wichita State.
Well, you know, we're proud to carry the banner for the state of Kansas. We know that certainly KU is always right at the top of the competition nationally. And, you know, we're thrilled to just have be a part of the discussion, really be in the stratosphere of KU there.
And Bobby, what about the broader, the Wichita community itself? Is there an excitement with the townsfolk as well?
Oh, absolutely. Wichita is on fire about Wichita State right now. We actually are running a social media campaign out of our office, an organic social media campaign, where we're asking Wichita businesses to put on their best and brightest Shocker gear and tweet us pictures of their staff and employees wearing Wichita State attire. And so we have that out right now, and I've been reached out to by so many local media outlets that want to be a part of all the excitement. So, no, there's no question it's a buzz. You can drive around here and see all of the businesses' signs with Wichita State promotion up. Of course, all of the t-shirt companies and retail outlets are going crazy. Our bookstore is going crazy. Wichita's on fire. Yeah, well, with Wichita State.
You talked about Twitter. What's the hashtag again?
It's hashtag MyWSUFinal4 and the number 4. So, again, that's hashtag MyWSUFinal4, the number 4.
Hey, Bobby, do you have a lot of people going down, a lot of students going down to Atlanta for the championship games?
As far as I know, the University Athletic Department had 3,200 tickets that they were able to distribute. And as far as I know, all of them or almost all of them are gone. They were also issued 700 tickets to give to students, and all of those were gone, I heard, in about 30 minutes or so.
Okay, before I let you go, I have to ask you about the school's nickname and mascot. the Shockers, it used to be Wheat Shockers, right? It was shortened to Shockers?
It was shortened to the Shockers.
Okay.
We started out. Oh, go ahead.
Well, and then I was going to ask you, when you were Fairmont College, didn't some of the students actually shock wheat in order to earn money to pay for their schooling? Isn't that how this nickname came about?
That's exactly right. You know, your Wichita State history, in many cases, was actually our football team and the players that would spend time shocking wheat and getting that together. And so we were the Wheat Shockers for a long time. That's really how we earned our nickname. And then later thereafter, we were shortened to be the Shockers.
Mm-hmm. One last quick question before I let you go, Bobby. Did you have them going to the Final Four in your bracket? Come on.
Can I plead the fifth on that one?
Yeah, we'll let you plead the fifth.
That was Wichita State University's Director of Admissions, Bobby Gandu, speaking to Bill Anderson on Central Standard last week. That was before the Shockers lost to Louisville in the Final Four this weekend. Speaking of college basketball, there's an ongoing battle between various places to lay claim to the inventor of the sport, James Naismith. His artifacts are scattered throughout the U.S. and Canada. As KCUR's Greg Eklund reports, some feel that Naismith's collection should be concentrated in one location. The question is, where?
She will now present the Maud Naismith Memorial Trophy to the players and coaches from Concordia University.
The Maud Naismith Trophy was first awarded 75 years ago after the University of Central Missouri successfully defended its first NAIA national championship. It's still in the trophy case there. In the late 70s, Central Missouri student Larry Stitt saw the trophy and became interested in Naismith. 10 years ago, Stitt walked through a tough Kansas City, Kansas neighborhood and into Palmer's Antique Store. There, he spied a children's book with Naismith's name on the cover.
And I asked Mrs. Palmer, who owned the store, does this thing have anything to do with the guy that coached basketball out at the University of Kansas? She goes, oh, yeah. And I go, really? And she goes, yes, my husband has a bunch of that stuff in the back room.
Stitt knew he had struck gold. After purchasing several children's books that once belonged to the Naismith family, Stitt's collection blossomed. He later bought family documents, photos, and even furniture that Naismith himself crafted. But he's not the only Naismith collector. Stephen Overbury sees himself as a rival.
One doesn't need a Springfield, Massachusetts mammoth money-losing and always-on-edge financially institution to wow things. That's the American style. Everything has to be big, powerful, important.
Overbury lives walking distance from the farm where Naismith grew up in Almont, Ontario, Canada. Calling himself a nationalistic Canadian, an ephemera collectibles dealer, and a basketball fan, Overbury purchased a collection of personal archives from the Naismith family 7 years ago. He talked about his collection by phone from his home, where he owns a bull named James Naismith and two noisy pet birds.
I recognize that this treasure trove of Canadian cultural heritage was about to be disseminated in the wind, probably to American collectors who would hoard it and brag about it and whatever. It would never be on public exhibit, and I was very concerned about that and went about trying to change that situation.
Becky Schulte is an archivist at the University of Kansas, where Naismith was the only Jayhawks coach with a career losing record. She would like to see Naismith artifacts gathered in one location in the U.S.
For the researcher, that's a definite benefit because they would be able to sit down in one place and at a place like Spencer Research Library where the University Archives is located and see as many things as possible.
Lestit shares Schulte's view. He helps his father with preserving his family's Naismith collection. It's been nice having the artifacts within the family, the younger Stitt says, but he acknowledges the need for an exhibit that draws from various collections.
I think really a collection that is of a person that is this important, not only to the history of basketball, but to the history of sporting in North America and in the world, I'd like to see the collection more accessible to the public.
Tom Keegan, the sports editor of the Lawrence Journal World newspaper, feels it should be at KU.
I think Dr. Naismith and his family made the argument for me. He's buried in Lawrence. So that's a pretty good claim right there. Where did he want to spend an eternity? Well, in heaven, but where did he want people to be able to see him for an eternity? Lawrence, Kansas.
What about Springfield, Massachusetts, or Elmont, Ontario?
Well, Springfield should have an argument. That's where he invented the game, so that's where they put the Hall of Fame. So, legitimate claim there as well. And Canada, you know, yes, he was born in Canada, Dr. Naismith, but for Canada to say that basketball is Canada's game, no, because he brought it here, he invented it here.
Plans are still in the works for the permanent display of Naismith's original rules at Kansas's Allen Fieldhouse, which sits on Naismith Drive.
That was KCUR's Greg Eklund. With the NCAA coming to a close, here comes baseball. In recent years, baseball games have become highly produced multimedia events. But despite all the changes technology has brought, two aspects of baseball remain the same: the sport and the announcer. This week, in honor of the Royals' home opener, we meet one of the most heard but least known team members.
1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10, 9, 8, 7, 6, 5, 4, 3, 2, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6.
In the hours leading up to a Royals home game, the players stretch and practice their swing. But driving in his car on the way to the stadium, announcer Mike McCartney has his own way of warming up. When McCartney was in junior high school, he realized his voice had become a little different from his classmates.
Everybody thought I was either my older brother or my dad when I'd answer the phone. Dad had he was a salesman, so he always had a great speaking voice. And I would get into halfway through conversations on the phone that people thought I was my father before I had to give the phone up and say, you've got the wrong guy.
Following the advice of his barber, McCartney got his first job in radio as a DJ in Pittsburgh, Kansas. He also picked up sports announcing gigs wherever he could. And after a couple of decades of announcing everything from basketball to dog racing, he finally signed on full-time with the Royals in 2000.
Ladies and gentlemen, boys and girls, it's time for another live edition of the Kauffman Stadium Hot Dog Derby. Pick your favorite. Ketchup, mustard, or relish. They're ready to roll.
In his years of announcing, McCartney says his voice has hardly ever given him any trouble, even during a 2010 doubleheader which went on past 1 in the morning. He rarely gets sick and doesn't have seasonal allergies, but McCartney says he has a few tricks to keep his voice in shape.
I never drink soda or milk. I never have milk for dinner before we go in to start our show. Water at room temperature only. Then sometimes I'll use a vocal spray. Sometimes the vocal cords can get kind of tired, so I'll use a vocal spray that kind of helps relax and get some moisture on the vocal cords.
The greatest hazard to a baseball announcer's night is the curveball of a tricky, unfamiliar name. And especially in recent years, McCartney says these have become more and more common.
Major League Baseball, like many sports, are so diverse right now that you get players from all over the world that come play. So it's very important before the game starts that you get with visiting team radio broadcasters and make sure that you get pronunciations correctly. And there's time you have to practice those sometimes.
Despite all his preparation, Mike McCartney admits to the occasional error.
I recall Doug Mitkevich, who he played for the Royals at one point, but he was a rookie with the Minnesota Twins, and I was probably in my first year as well, and he came up to bat, and I think I introduced him as Doug Minkiewiczki or whatever it was, and I thought, that can't be right. I kept thinking to myself, and sure enough, someone comes into the booth, and in fact, it was Greg Eklund, who I know is on your staff, and he said, Mike, I think that's Mintkiewicz, don't you think? And I said, you know, Greg, I said, I think you're right about that. So,
this year, Mike McCartney looks forward to reaching his 1,000th game straight without a game off. He says that for a baseball fan like him, coming to work at the stadium night after night is about as good as it gets.
Being able to have a job that pays you and gives you a nice seat and in air conditioning in the summertime, nonetheless, you really can't beat it.
Here comes Relish on the inside. Ketchup looks like it's out of it. Neck and neck, wiener to wiener. Here they come. Here comes Ketchup on the inside.
2013 will be Mike McCartney's 13th season as the Royals announcer. For Casey Currents, I'm Alex Smith.
And it's Ketchup by three lengths.
KCUR's Up to Date will be broadcasting tomorrow morning from Kauffman Stadium for the Royals' home opener.
Coming up, hear about the development of Black Israelite groups in Kansas. You're listening to Casey Currents. This is Casey Currents. I'm Susan Wilson.
And I'm Sylvia Maria Gross. Blacks and Jews have historically had a complicated relationship in the United States, and maybe most of all when they claim the same religion or historical ancestry. The development of Black Israelite or Black Jewish faith has its roots in Kansas, according to a new book by a University of Kansas professor.
This interpretation of the biblical roots of Africans has spread far, from New York to South Africa and back to Israel, and it sparked no shortage of controversy. Some Black Israelite groups have even been considered hate groups. We'll hear from the author of the book in a few minutes, but first, a local man tells us how he became interested in Judaism.
My birth name is Brian Michael Long, so my mother named me. As a part of my conversion, I am now known as Mikhail Korban Ben Avraham Vassara.
How did you first get involved in the Hebrew-Israelite religion?
Interesting journey. It started in college, just doing a lot of self-searching. Had gone through some vicious cycles of a typical student-athlete life, you know, and just felt myself empty. I was raised a Christian of the Disciples of Christ denomination, so initially I identified as a Christian, but just through research, study, and just a big journey, I guess you could say, I came to understand through understanding history and both prophecy that African-Americans have Hebrew heritage. So that just led me to inquire more into that background. I've come to understand it's more of a cultural heritage as opposed to a religion. And so I think to really get that understood, you know, we have a cultural heritage of an Israelite identity as opposed to really a religious identity, because it just it infuses every aspect of our life to understand of yourself as an Israelite.
What do you think especially appealed to you about the whole Hebrew-Israelite story, theology, etc.?
One, it provides an answer to a big question about our identity as African-Americans, you know, that being stripped from us through our enslavement. It really provided an answer and a concrete identity that, you know, not only we can ethnically embrace, but we can also nationally embrace. Because, I mean, if you just look at history as a nation, America had never really embraced us as a people historically, even presently. It provided a cultural refuge, and then it provided also a greater context to understand the scriptures. As a Christian, there were a lot of gaps that I know I had from just understanding things from a Western Christian standpoint. But as I got more into the cultural identity of being an Israelite, it makes the scriptures that much more clear, and even having an idiomatic understanding.
So I have to ask you, do you feel like you're often understood by others because of your religious preference?
My experience is really not so much. I mean, people know that, you know, I have some different views, but I don't think they really, oh, here comes, you know, DeVar or Michael, the Black Jew. It's not so much like that. No, I mean, At one point in time, I think I did wear it more on my sleeve, but as I've matured and, you know, kind of grown into it, it's something that, you know, people just notice and inquire more so. But they don't really just, oh, here he comes, a black. No, it's not like that.
So you didn't have to explain your religious choice to, let's say, friends or family who might have been a part of more traditional.
Mm-hmm. Initially. I mean, it was an initial probably time it was like that, yeah, where they were like, so what are you doing? You know, because there are major differences in Israelite culture, of course. We recognize the Sabbath, you know, Friday night to Saturday night. We keep all the scriptural holy days. Our diets are different. So there were some things initially that people questioned, but, you know, it's become more, I guess, accepted.
What does the Hebrew Israelite movement look like in Kansas City? Is there a church, for example?
Or? Mm-hmm. At least, I'm thinking in the greater Kansas City area, there's about 100 at least I can think of individuals who identify as such. There probably is more. There's about probably 6 or 7 camps in Kansas City. And I think one of the ideas people have of Israelites is the New York on the corner hollering and insulting people and kind of shoving it down your throat. You know, they're dressed up in the ancient attire more so. But that's not all Kansas City. Kansas City has everything from people who, you know, are just everyday 9-to-5 people to those who are more on the corner and preaching, you know, with some more fire and brimstone kind of sermon, I guess you could say.
Now, to what extent do the camps in Kansas City adhere to black nationalist kinds of ideologies?
I would assume that it pretty much has a strong influence in most of the camps, not to the point of being of supremacist thought, you know, more indigenous thought, like we are the original, which has to be understood in the context of do for self and self-determination. More so as opposed to like a supremacist thought. I do believe there's an FBI report that has a black Hebrew Israelites as one of the extremist groups to be, you know, on the lookout for. But that's not the case for all Israelites. There may be some who are more extreme in their views. Kansas City, to my knowledge, does not have any extremist activity.
You know, I was going to ask you about that because the Southern Poverty Law Center does identify certain black Israelite groups as black supremacists, mm-hmm. hate groups, mm-hmm. anti-gay. What do you think about that?
My thoughts are like, you know, each group is going to have its own character. And it's pretty much made up based on the experiences of the individuals who come together. I'm not one who condones extremist activity. Personally, I'm a man of peace. Anything that deals with hate, it's not scriptural, you know, to the point where we can come together and break bread and fellowship and reason, the important word reason, to, you know, come to some understandings and prayerfully lead someone, if they are out of line, to repentance. So, yeah, I think the extremist notions are ridiculous.
So where does your camp worship?
We had a small group that would come together at, you know, people's houses. As we've matured, we have gravitated to synagogues. For instance, I'm a member of Ohev Shalom Synagogue on 75th and Knoll. Interestingly, a lot of the people that I once fellowshiped with have made what's called Aliyah. They've gone home to Israel.
So you actually worship in a traditional Jewish synagogue.
Yes, indeed.
Now, how are black Israelites received by, let's say, Jewish people of European descent, mm-hmm. in the local synagogues?
I have had mostly good experiences. Early on, I had kind of a interesting, I guess, dialogue with someone where they asked if I was Jewish, but the way it was said was kind of, you're not Jewish, are you? I'm like, at the time, I didn't really have an understanding, so I was like, no, I was really, you know, on a search. So that kind of rubbed me in a interesting way, I guess you could say. But the synagogue I attend, there's several African-American families that attend the synagogue and were not treated with any difference. whatsoever. They may kind of confuse us sometimes, you know.
In what way?
I mean, you know, one brother I fellowship with, he comes to the synagogue with me. We may kind of resemble each other. We both have full beards, short hair, about the same complexion. So they may call me his name sometimes and, you know, call him my name. So, but other than that, I mean, it's all love, you know. It's an embracing, warm environment. And that's why I really have settled at Ohev Shalom and have great respect for the rabbi there. And there's also a chaplain rabbi there that, I mean, have received us with open arms, you know, and even the congregation itself has received us with open arms.
That was Michael Long, also known as DeVar. To hear more about the development of Black Israelite movements in the United States, we now turn to history and American studies professor Jacob Dorman, the author of The Chosen People, The Rise of Black Israelite Religions. Welcome to KC Currents.
Thank you so much for having me.
What interested you in Black Israelites particularly?
I was very interested in Black nationalism and Jewish nationalism or Zionism. I was interested in that comparison and in their similarities. And so Black Jews were a topic that allowed me to really explore both of those things. And I think that they challenge both Jewish identity, but also they have a lot to teach us, I think, about Black identity and the process of forming new religions and new cultures in the Americas in general. So it's just been an endlessly fascinating topic for me.
I noticed from reading the book that there's some variation in the words people use to describe Black Israelite movements or religions. So when you use the term Black Israelite, what does this mean to you?
Well, Black Israelite, and the way I'm using it is really the way people in the communities have used it over the last century. Black Israelites identify with the ancient Israelites. They believe that the ancient Israelites were Black and that contemporary Black people are their descendants. Oftentimes that means believing that Jesus was Black. So Israelite does not necessarily denote a specific religion, but among Black Israelites, you might have Black Jews, you might have Christians, you might have Rastafarians, even Black Muslims. Many Black Muslims would share the basic tenets of the beliefs of Black Israelites. My focus in the book is on Black Jews who are practicing variants of Judaism. But there's other religions. Most Black Israelites today are Christians, and that's probably true 100 years ago as well.
Can you explain the customs of Black Israelites, how they worship?
There's a huge range. Some of the groups practice forms of Judaism today that are very similar to the forms of Judaism practiced in Sephardic or Ashkenazi synagogues of European derivation. They practice all the same festivals. They practice the same high holidays. They would read from the Torah on Shabbat. They would follow kashrut, or they would keep the laws of the dietary laws. Then there's other groups like the Church of God and Saints of Christ, which started actually in Lawrence, Kansas in 1896. And they also follow many of the same festivals, but they have their own liturgy, which is quite unique and really quite beautiful. So there's many different forms of Judaism that are quite robust and that have changed as well over the last century. But you could say the same thing about Ashkenazi or Sephardic Judaism of today is, you know, quite different than it was as it was practiced 150 years ago in Eastern Europe. So religions are always changing and evolving. And, you know, I would love it if more Jews of European descent actually visited and came to appreciate some of these forms of Judaism created by Black Israelites, because they're really quite exceptional and quite beautiful.
Now, you mentioned Lawrence. I imagine people might be surprised to know that Kansas played a role in this whole story about Black Israelites. Now, you write that Kansas was viewed as a kind of a promised land for Blacks after emancipation. What was it about Kansas at that time that made it a place where black Israelites flourished and the movement was kind of born?
Northeast Kansas, as many listeners know, was one of the centers of African-American life during and after the Civil War, partly because of its legacy as a free state and the place where John Brown fought. It acquired a reputation, almost a saintly reputation, in the minds of many African-Americans because of that conflict of the 1850s. And then in the 1870s, Kansas, as its population boomed and it attracted immigrants from all over the world, it also attracted African-Americans who came to farm and find independence. And so Northeast Kansas actually had two of the only cities in the country that had a black percentage that was over 20% in Atchison and Topeka. So it was a major center of black population. Lawrence was around 20% as well, African-American. It was also on the Santa Fe Railroad line, and it was there that Prophet William Saunders Crowdy decided to start preaching his message.
Now, you mentioned Prophet Crowdy. Some reports back then, you write, said that he acted strangely. He was hearing voices. Was he a prophet or a madman?
That's probably an eternal question for people that have a direct line to God. But he, you know, was able to attract thousands of followers. So he certainly wasn't treated as a madman by his contemporaries. But there is a line that no one's a prophet in their own hometown. I think his wife was certainly a little bit displeased when this religious phase started to express itself. But he, you know, was able to convince even very hostile audiences that he was speaking the truth and that he was divinely blessed and gifted. And he was really a tremendous evangelist. He showed up in New York City and within months had 2,000 followers and repeated the same thing in Philadelphia. So he really was quite effective and helped to transform the American religious landscape because he was preaching a form of holiness, Christianity, but he was able to create thousands of followers who believed that, as he did, that the ancient Israelites were black and that contemporary blacks had kind of a direct line to that inheritance. And he was doing this in a time when, you know, there was lynching and Jim Crow discrimination across the country. So his message really found open ears.
And that's how he was able to spread the movement to the bigger cities of the Northeast. And there was even a South African connection.
That's right. There was a West Indian-born missionary named Albert Christian who was working with the AME Church, the African Methodist Episcopal Church, which is the first independent black denomination. And Christian came to Philadelphia, and according to the story spread by the Church of God and the Saints of Christ, Crowdy's church, Christian found Bishop Crowdy and recognized him immediately as a person he had actually seen in a dream, and he accepted the teachings and he spread them to South Africa when he returned there in 1903. And so one of the really amazing things about this story is that the Crowdy's church, which started here in Lawrence, Kansas, spread to South Africa in 1903, and it's been a transnational African-American directed church for over 100 years. So this teaching, the Israelite teaching, spread into South Africa, and it spread to other churches, and it helped to inspire other African-initiated churches. It taught people that, in this case, in South Africa, people that were being occupied and colonized, or in the States, African Americans, people that were being Jim Crowed and segregated and in extreme cases lynched and quite commonly disenfranchised. It taught people in both cases that they, in actuality, had a glorious past as the people of the book, the chosen people, people directly descended from the ancient Israelites. And it helped to really transform the consciousness of African and African-American people.
I'm Susan Wilson, and you're listening to KC Currents. We're talking with KU American Studies professor Jacob Dorman about his book, The Chosen People, The Rise of Black Israelite Religions. The Black Israelite movement drew criticism from both African-American Christians and Eastern European Jews. Why the criticism?
Jews of European descent had quite an embattled relationship with Black Israelites or Black Jews, as some of them became, that probably lasted from the 20s really into the present and to some extent. And they clashed over many things. One was just over the question of who was a Jew. They tended to get into these kinds of arguments. Black Jewish leaders of the 1920s who started to form synagogues as opposed to churches. They started to form more Judaic forms of Black Israelitism during the Harlem Renaissance. And they tended to preach that they were the true Jews and that white Jews were imposters, that the white Jews were descended from Esau or from Edom, rather, that they were Edomites and not true Jews and not legitimate. Most white Jews probably saw the black Jews as illegitimate as well. And there are some exceptions to that. There were several efforts in the during the civil rights movement to try to bring these two communities closer together. But neither group really wanted to validate the other group. And that's only starting to change really in the last decade.
Black Israelite sects believed, as you said, that Africans were severed from Jewish religion during the Roman age, and they might have been part of the lost tribes of Israel, etc. Is there any evidence of this?
Well, they would say yes. There's quite a lot of evidence, and they would look at a mix of sort of textual evidence from the Bible, I am black and comely, in the Song of Songs and many other passages of scriptures, to say that the ancient Israelites were people of color. And then there's, in the 20th century, there's been a stream of kind of amateur anthropologists who point to ethnographic cultural data to say that contemporary West African peoples are descended from ancient Israelites. And I guess most recently there's been a number of scholars that have looked at African historical, contemporary kind of African historical sources to point to what they claim are Israelite and Assyrian origins for many African peoples. My position is I haven't attempted to take a position on those beliefs. And in my reading, these are religious beliefs, and it would be kind of as inappropriate for me to try to prove or disprove them as it would be for me to try to prove or disprove the resurrection or any of the kind of sacred beliefs of any other religion. I will say that I don't think that there's solid historical proof that most secular historians would accept. But you could say the same thing of the alleged links between, my Eastern European ancestors and the Israelites. So I think the really interesting thing is how people, all people, not simply Black Israelites, but how all people create stories and narratives to try to explain their past and to link themselves to a historied sense of.
So what's the Black Israelite movement like today?
Well, it's changed a lot, and it's constantly changing. There's basically three waves of Black Israelite movements. The first would be the movement of the Holiness churches of the 1890s and the early 1900s. And this is the Prophet Crowdy, Bishop Christian, and there's many other leaders and many other Holiness churches that incorporated those Israelite ideas. And then in the 1920s, the period of the Harlem Renaissance, you have the rise of Judaic forms of Black Israelite churches that adopt Judaism. And then in the 60s, in the Civil Rights era, you have the rise of a third wave of Black nationalist Black Israelite groups. And these are the groups that are most famous for their various cable TV shows or for their public preaching on the streets of New York and whatnot. A lot of these movements tend to be quite masculinist, quite patriarchal, to have very strong, sometimes even violent rhetoric, to emphasize immigrationism or migration or colonization.
I want to ask you that some sects of Black Israelite congregations today have been labeled Black supremacists or hate groups by the Southern Poverty Law Center. Is this fair? Are they misunderstood?
Well, you know, there's so many different groups that you really would have to take, I think, a case-by-case example. The largest of these groups is probably the original African Hebrew Israelite nation that moved from Chicago to Dimona, Israel in 1969. And their rhetoric when they first came to Israel was quite divisive. They said, this is our land, not your land. They promised to push the white Jews into the sea. Literally, they said things like that. But then that rhetoric very quickly changed, and they started to seek ways to accommodate themselves and to live in peace with their neighbors, and they've succeeded at that.
How about the sects in America now, the Black Israelite sects in America right now?
The biggest organization is probably the Church of God and Saints of Christ, which was the biggest one in 1903. I mean, it's the one that started in Lawrence, Kansas in 1896. And I think in, say, the last decade, I think there's been kind of a maturation. I think from both sides, from white Jews and from Black Jews, you hear less divisive rhetoric. Michelle Obama's cousin, Rabbi Capers Funye, leads a congregation on the south side of Chicago and has actually been accepted into the Chicago Board of Rabbis. So he is somebody who is kind of accepted by everybody, by Black Jews, by white Jews. There's more and more, there's African Americans who have multi-generational histories of practicing Judaism who are becoming part of majority white communities and schools, including in the Kansas City area. So there's a kind of process that happens, I think, over generations. And I think the Jewish community as a whole is becoming much more diverse through the incorporation of Israelite groups, through conversion and through adoption. And I think there's a real interest among many more progressive Jews in moving beyond a racialist definition of Judaism and accepting people and welcoming people of color.
Jake Dorman, thank you for joining us today on KC Currents.
Well, thank you so much, Susan. I really appreciate your interest. It's great to be here.
Jacob Dorman is a professor of history and American studies at the University of Kansas. His book is called The Chosen People, The Rise of Black Israelite Religions.
If you can't listen to all of Casey Currents today, catch what you missed online in our audio archives. And we've got a podcast. Find us on iTunes.
After the break, poetry that evokes the Kansas landscape. This is Casey Currents.
This is Casey Currents. I'm Sylvia Maria Gross.
And I'm Susan Wilson.
In area news this week, Wyandotte County elected a new mayor. Kansas City, Missouri voted yes, yes, and no. And a council committee voted to give wings to plans for a new airport. Steve Bell recaps those and other top stories of the week on the KCUR Weekend News Review.
The city council committee endorsed moving ahead with the planning phase for a single terminal concept KCI airport. The new airport would cost more than $1 billion to be paid by the federal government and the airlines. But the project would involve municipal bonds, and aviation director Mark Van Loo tried to assure critics that the new design keeps the access characteristics so popular at the present KCI.
It's no different than it is today. You'll be able to pull off, go right into one of many doors, going right into the ticketing and security area and straight to your gate.
The city would not be responsible for paying bond investors, but issuing municipal bonds requires voter approval. Tuesday's elections came out just the way Kansas City, Missouri leaders had hoped. Mayor Sly James summed it up.
People of Kansas City know how to make decisions that are in the best interest of the totality. Question one, to provide medical services to those in need. Question two, there's really no reason for us to give up $2 million a year when nobody else is doing it. Question three, why would we jettison jobs on a future prospect that can't even be defined?
Question three would have prohibited future city incentives for any manufacturing related to nuclear weapons. Voters in Wyandotte County chose Mark Holland as mayor. Holland said one of the biggest problems facing Kansas City, Kansas is state budget cuts.
Cuts coming through for our education and cuts against municipalities are hurting our city.
Holland captured 56% of the vote. Missouri Governor Jay Nixon talked with Republicans about a compromise Medicaid expansion built on their alternative to his proposal. But Nixon wants the maximum qualifying income cutoff raised to 138% of the federal poverty level. Kansas City Democrat Kevin McManus sponsored an amendment to do that.
Folks who have testified for this bill have made abundantly clear that we need to raise the eligibility standard in order to get those matching funds.
But a House committee rejected the amendment, and Republican support for their own alternative plan was declining. They did continue to talk about income tax cuts. To the consternation of education leaders like Lee's Summit Superintendent David McGee.
Missouri's funding for public schools is already more than $600 million below what is required to fund its own foundation formula, with no real plan in sight to ever see full funding.
Kansas Governor Sam Brownback signed the bill prohibiting political cause payroll deductions for state and local government union employees and signed one extending the statute of limitations on rape. For child victims, it'll be till they're 28. Wyandotte County Deputy DA Cheryl Litke applauded that.
There needs to be some protection for children out there who are not brave enough, don't have the courage, or frankly are being threatened and can't come forward with their disclosures until a much later date.
Before heading home for a month, legislators sent Brownback a controversial abortion bill that defined life as beginning at fertilization, one invalidating local prevailing wage contract requirements, one opening more public buildings, colleges, and schools to concealed carry, and a bill making it a felony to enforce any federal gun control on firearms made and kept in Kansas. They have not yet agreed on tax or budget bills. This is KCUR.
If you're from Kansas, you know the state's motto, Ad Astra Per Aspera. To the stars through difficulties. That's the inspiration of the latest poetry collection edited by Kansas poet laureate Karen Merriam Goldberg. To the stars through difficulties at Kansas Renga in 150 voices.
Arenga is a collaborative form of Japanese poetry, usually about nature. Here, each poet had just 48 hours to write 10 lines about the Kansas landscape, and then the next poet writes 10 more in response to the previous poem. The poets in To the Stars Through Difficulties range from laureates like Miriam Goldberg to unpublished writers just starting out. Next week, we'll hear from Miriam Goldberg about the book, but today, a reading from Sean Pavey.
Listening. How wheat bristles in wind like telegraph wires, charged with particles carrying voices of dark communications, deeper than music of our bright songbirds. Seeds of prairie grasses crack secret in the loam, yearn for wildfires of blanketing shoots.
That was Sean Pavey reading his portion of the Kansas Renga, To the Stars Through Difficulties. Pavey is the editor of the Main Street Rag. Throughout the month of April, we'll be airing the work of different local poets. You can hear some of the writers in the Kansas Renga at the KU Continuing Education Building in Lawrence on April 18th. For more information, visit us at kcur.org.
We appreciate you tuning in to KC Currents. This show will be archived along with all of our past shows on the KC Currents page at kcur.org.
You can also hear individual stories there or sign up for our podcast. Find us on iTunes. You can contact us at kccurrents@kcur.org or on Twitter at kccurrents.
KC Currents is produced by Sylvia with associate producer Alex Smith. Our intern is Monica Sandretsky, and our theme music is by Approach. I'm Susan Wilson.
And I'm Sylvia Maria Gross.